The modern industrialized world is a complex system on a scale never before witnessed in the history of mankind. Humankind. Technologically dependent, globally interconnected, it offers seemingly limitless conveniences, choices, and opportunities, yet this same modern civilization may be as unstable as a house of cards. That's what complexity scientists like John Casty think. All it would take to downsize our way of life, send us crashing back to the 1800s, is a nudge from what Casty calls an X event, an unpredictable occurrence, with extreme, even dire consequences. When an X event strikes, and scientists believe it will, finance, communication, defense, and travel will stop. The flow of food, electricity, medicine, and clean water will be disrupted for months, if not years. The question is, what will you do? Well, it seems to me like the thing to do would be to get ahead of it a little bit. We'll find out if that's possible with Dr. John Casty when we return on Coast to Coast AM. American complexity scientist and systems theorist John Casty, PhD, co-founder of the X Center, a Vienna-based research institute focusing on human-caused extreme events and how to anticipate them. Previously, he was a senior research scholar at the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis, where he headed an initiative on extreme events in human society, worked for many years at the Santa Fe Institute and the RAND Corporation, has also served on the faculties of Princeton University, University of Arizona, and New York University. Former editor of the journal Complexity, he has published nearly 20 volumes of academic and popular science and received his PhD in mathematics from the University of Southern California and lives in a very beautiful part of the world. Welcome, Dr. Casty.
Very nice to be with you this evening.
This is quite a very nice book, and the title even is alarming, X Events. That has an ominous tone to it, and it does. And in looking through this, it's... It does sort of look like the old house of cards, doesn't it? And I'm wondering how close we are to one of these X events, because one of the words used in the description of an X event is the unpredictable nature of it, and yet you have isolated a number of things which seem likely.
Well, I wouldn't say that likely is exactly the word that I would use.
Excellent.
I would say possible.
Okay, that's better.
The point of this book is to point out that there are many possibilities, and that just because they're threatening or even seem unlikely or something that we don't want to have happen, it doesn't mean we can just ignore them. We can't just say, oh, that's so terrible, I don't want to think about it, therefore it can't happen. It can happen.
And that's that denial thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so my book, X Events, is really, I think it's a kind of positive book, not negative at all. And so you shouldn't be misled by the subtitle, you know, the collapse of everything. It's not really about the end of the world in any sense. It's about what might happen, how it might happen, how it would affect our lives if it did happen, and what we might be able to do about it today, by way of at least being a survivor, if not even perhaps a beneficiary of that event.
Sort of a from order or from chaos order.
Yeah, some kind of recognition of the fact that if an X event actually happens, like something like a long-term crash of the internet or a disruption of the food supply network or whatever, that in the let's say immediate short term, this is a terrible thing. Lots of people's lives will be turned upside down, and in general, it's something that we don't look forward to at all. But if you take a little bit longer term perspective, you can start seeing that there is a positive side to even the most negative kind of event. And that positive side is that the creation of an X event, and let me give you an example. Think about the Japanese nuclear power plant, Fukushima, that caused lots of damage, lots of loss of life, and so on. And I was speaking in Japan in April, and I said to the audiences that I was talking to, I said, you know, here, just 1 year after this event, you guys are very depressed. You think this was like one of the worst things that ever happened to Japan. But I said that if I went to sleep today for 10 years and woke up, I'd be willing to bet that many, if not all of you in this room, would say, this wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to Japan. It was one of the best things that ever happened to Japan, because it freed up the possibility, degrees of freedom, if you like, to restructure many aspects of Japanese life. The political system, you can already see it's undergoing restructuring, the economic system, and so on. So this kind of creative destruction is, in general, necessary in order to break out of old patterns that cannot really be changed in some slow, gradual, evolutionary fashion. It really takes a revolution. And these X events are typically catalysts which bring about that possibility.
That's interesting, because the first note that I made was, are these X events necessary for humankind to evolve? It appears they are.
Well, in fact, go way back, like 65 million years ago, to that asteroid that blew away the dinosaurs. At that time, human beings were little furry, four-legged things scurrying around about the size of a cat. But the disappearance of the dinosaurs was bad news for the dinosaurs, but real good news for us. Because we then evolved over that period of time to where we are today. But we wouldn't have had those eco niches to evolve into if the asteroid had not come and turned life upside down. So this is a kind of common pattern. And, you know, you could say, gee, it would be nice to create those degrees of freedom, create those opportunities for change without having to destroy the old order. But that doesn't seem to be the way human nature is structured, or nature in general, actually, that almost always it requires you have to be blasted out of the orbit that you're currently operating in order to move on to something, presumably, hopefully, bigger and better. And I think that happens in personal lives, too. You know, you think about relationships that you're in, that somehow you recognize that these relationships are essentially over, but it takes a major blast to get you out of it. You know, you can't usually just sort of say, well, I know it's over now, I've got to slowly move away. And sometimes it happens that way, but it's not the way to bet.
You know, I suppose you would certainly have to have your own take on human psychology, since these X events are largely this is stuff that human beings do. They cause financial problems, and they cause nuclear problems, and so forth. We have this threat of very intensive or intense solar activity, collapse of the grid, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of the perceptible X events, the possibilities of X events, how many of them are just beyond our control, and how many of them are caused by humans? Your focus is on human-caused events, yes?
Yeah. I deliberately wrote this book, X Events, in order to focus on the fact that is sometimes sort of not ignored, perhaps, but soft-pedaled, the fact that humans, by our inaction, miscommunication, misunderstanding, stupidity, or perhaps even malevolent intent, can cause a lot more damage to ourselves than many natural events. So my book does not really focus at all on things that nature throws in our path, earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, volcanic eruptions, and so on. There's plenty of literature on that. And a lot of people have been studying these natural hazards, natural X events, for a long time. But what we haven't really come to terms with, in my view, is the kinds of extreme events I just mentioned, collapse of the internet, financial crash, food supply breakdown, communications breakdown, etc., that we cause ourselves. So I've actually tried in this book, X Events, to focus on how does that happen? What's the underlying root cause for how these human-caused X events actually get generated. And you're right, human psychology plays an important role. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Mood Matters, which was exactly about this role that collective human psychology, more than individuals, but how a group or a population feels about its future. Are they, or more, not so much even feeling, what do they believe about their future? They're optimistic, looking forward to the future, then the types of events that you can expect to see are very different in character than if people are pessimistic about the future, if they believe that tomorrow is going to be worse than today. And so this book, X Events, the current book that just came out last week, is a kind of, it's not really a sequel, it's the next, let's say, next step in a sequence of telling why X events happen. And my argument is they happen because of what I call complexity overload, where the systems involved, whether it's communication, transportation, electric power, or whatever, they become too complex for us to effectively understand. And at some point, the complexity level spills over to the point where the systems have to be downsized. And human nature being what it is, almost never are we eager to deliberately and voluntarily downsize. And when the systems need to be downsized, then human nature will step in and essentially say, if you won't do it for yourself, then I have to do it for you. And that doing it for you is usually an X event, an extreme event.
So, you know, you're a first-time guest on Coast to Coast AM, is my understanding. And
right.
Of course, I'm delighted to be the lucky guy to interview you for the first time on the show. But I warn you, Doctor, I'm going to be all over the place tonight because... It seems to me that the biggest potential X event is a really bad decision on the part of some incompetent leader. How is it that men like you, who study these things, do not wind up in positions of leadership?
Well,
so, I mean, for example,
maybe,
I think it was a...
Maybe I'd like to believe that it's because we're too smart to actually want to take on those kind of roles.
Well, put your whole life out on the clothesline for the whole world to see, yeah.
Thankless jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, nobody walks out of politics broke, that's for sure. But, you know, it seems to me it's kind of making that nest egg.
Well, on the other hand, a lot of them seem to end up in the courtrooms nowadays. So,
Isn't that true? And, you know, I railed forever about no one on Wall Street has been punished for these heinous financial atrocities, but it looks like somebody from Goldman Sachs went down, so at least there's hope.
Yeah.
For example, I don't think it was a very good idea. Call me Stone Age. Or old school, that'd be better. But I don't think it's a very good idea to run absolutely everything over the internet. Do we create problems for us? And I have known individuals who have actually been bored with their current state of success, so they will create a huge problem just so that they won't be bored and they'll have something to do with. Is this a propensity of humankind to actually not really self-sabotage, but certainly... a self-induced malfunction that will somehow spur some sort of evolutionary move in whatever system they happen to be maladjusting?
Well, you know, you're really asking me to engage in a bit of armchair psychology here, and I'm not a psychologist by profession. But so I, like everybody else, I have an opinion, and my opinion is that humans, by our very nature, we crave novelty in our lives. Some kind, that's why we go shopping and buy new products. It's why we look for new authors at the bookstore or on the internet nowadays, and so on. The novelty is necessary, and I think that if you get into a position where your life is too patterned, that you deliberately go out of your way to put yourself into a position where novelty can come into your life. You know, maybe you do it in a self-destructive way. I think a lot of, personal affairs, you know, extramarital affairs or whatever, are the underlying cause is just a desire for novelty. It's not something else. But there are many other examples of a similar type, and maybe even at a collective level, at a level of a society. It wouldn't surprise me. I've never done a study on it, but it seems reasonable to imagine that sometimes wars even are initiated just for the sake of change, if you like. Not because there's any special benefit to be gained from it, but just to keep things lively, so to speak.
Just keep things shaken up.
Yeah, shake things up a bit. There you go.
And when you use the word novelty, you know, a lot of definitions, it seems to me, in this day and age, they're imparted to people through some sort of osmosis rather than an actual understanding of the word. When you say novelty, you don't really mean you don't mean to imply amusement or maybe entertainment,
no,
but not
different.
Amusements. This is
just
not a different. Toy.
Yeah, like when you go to the food shop, for example, you see 17 varieties of dog food. Well, they're really, in general, distinctions without a real difference. But somehow it's very important for people to imagine that they really have a choice, that there are many different possibilities in their life at that moment, and they can select out of this spectrum of 17 different packages of stuff that they can give to their cat or dog. And it's that kind of novelty.
Good grief. Well, look, now we can get into what are the most likely X events and how close they may be, but it's these humans that are at the root of this problem. And so I'm curious, does any of your research indicate perhaps an evolutionary step from this sort of petty search for novelty, which in the broad strokes has the potential to, you know, really disrupt and dis-ease the world?
But for some, this search for novelty is a exhilarating experience, and they wouldn't want to be sort of stuck in a kind of standard pattern of life that goes on the same way every single day. I think that if you look back through human history, there are always people who feel that they want to take charge, they want to get ahead, or maybe they're issues of power. They want to be able to restrict degrees of freedom in somebody else's life. Maybe that gives them some measure of satisfaction. And so essentially that's what power consists of, being able to impose your will upon others to restrict what they can do in their lives.
I hope everybody's hearing that. That was very pregnant.
Well, it seems, unfortunately, the historical record is pretty clear on this point, that human nature being what it is, it hasn't changed much, and it's not likely to undergo any major evolutionary or revolutionary change in your lifetime or mine. And if I went to sleep today and woke up in 2 million years, I have a shelves of books here from science fiction writers and other kinds of speculators about what things might be like then, but what they might be like, who can say, you know. But my own guess is that the historical record being what it is, it's not going to change all that much. Human nature, you're not going to reprogram these basic primitive patterns that were put into the human brain millions of years ago.
Yeah, the only real way to do that would be through some sort of huge, gigantic, unspeakably powerful governing force that could somehow make humans less human. It might make them safer in the short run, but not very interesting in the long run.
Well, of course, you know, if we can already see the effect of, let's say, small-scale experiments in that kind. If you look at various totalitarian societies from the past, they don't have a very good track record of lasting too long.
Very good. I'll tell you what, let's take a little hard break here and we'll come back with more. Dr. John Casty, X Events, the end of everything. Or is it? This is Ghost. Well, thank you very much, and happy Father's Day to anybody who's in the after midnight of the 16th and into the 17th. Happy Father's Day to everybody. We are talking to, well, not everybody, but the guys who are fathers. We're talking about X events with Dr. John Casty. And I've got a question that's been dogging me for a long time. You take a highly evolved, very wonderful society, art, music, architecture, all kinds of things, like Russia that became the Soviet Union, and then it all went away. And we have a fixation going now, and for good reason, on a new world order. But there's a chapter in X Events by Dr. Casty entitled A New World Disorder. Oh, and that kind of intrigues me. So let's get into that and much more when we return. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Mikhail Gorbachev's resignation as president of the USSR on Christmas Day 1991 was a moment of hope for Russian liberals who saw the dissolution of the Soviet Union as an opportunity for the Russian populace to join into the political, social, and economic life of the industrialized Western world. But then what happened, Dr. Casty?
Well, what happened was a bit of a setback, and in fact, a huge setback in the Boris Yeltsin time, which ultimately ended up in a kind of a land grab in the former Soviet Union with a lot of people who are now termed Russian oligarchs, grabbing off huge chunks of the natural wealth of the country. And, of course, it was like, at the time, I can remember the newspaper articles, people describing the former Soviet Union as the Wild Wild East, where, you know, it was basically run by a bunch of gangs, and there were criminal mafias, if you like, in competition with each other, people getting shot on the street, and so on and so forth. And then Mr. Putin came into power and at least stabilized the country, but stabilized it in a form that seems to bear a kind of eerie resemblance to the former Soviet times in a lot of different ways. But I think that this is just a manifestation of a much bigger global transformation that's underway right now, and which I wrote about in one of the chapters in X Events. In that book, I point out something I think is now becoming pretty clear to everyone, and that is that the old rules of world order, the rules that were more or less put in place after the Second World War, they don't seem to work very well anymore. And what we're seeing in the both political, geopolitical, and financial domains especially, but also in the social domains, is the fact that these rules don't work. You know, the financial crises that we're still embedded in today, there's a lot of floundering around on the part of governments and international financial agencies, essentially trying to use the old rules to stabilize and turn this global economy around, and they're pretty unsuccessful. And the problem is that nobody really knows what the new rules are. Nobody knows what the rules are that actually will work. And so it's a kind of hit-and-miss, trial-and-error process, and that those rules are being put in place, the new rules are being put in place in a kind of a real-time basis. And this is a kind of interesting time to be alive because we're in the transition period. Transition period from the old that doesn't work to the new, which we don't know what it is, but it may or may not work. And this makes most people very uncomfortable because, you know, if you're a businessman, you can't plan for the future. You know, if you're having to try and make multi-million or even multi-billion dollar bets today on what the world is going to look like 5, 10, 20 years from now, it's very difficult to make those bets because you don't have much of a clue as to what the world is going to look like 5, 10, 20 years from now. My own guess, and it's just that, is that we will have a world that will have what one would call a multipolar world, where there'll be a half dozen major powers, not any one of which has, you know, the ultimate upper hand. It's not going to be China. It's not going to be U.S. It's not going to be Brazil. It'll be some mixture of all of these. And this is going to make the world of the future a pretty tricky place to navigate, because nobody will be in charge.
Well, and some will form alliances as well with each other.
Yeah, there will be alliances that will form up and then come undone. They'll form up around some issues, and they'll be in conflict about other issues. And just in general, I think it will be a period of great opportunity for some. Because, again, you're in a situation then when there are all sorts of new degrees of freedom that have been generated by the disappearance of the old world order and the non-appearance yet of a new stable world order. But as a mathematician by training, I studied at one time in my life game theory, which is really about conflict resolution. And if you have more than two players, if you like, who are in conflict, then all sorts of wild and pretty interesting possibilities, as you just said, coalitions, side payments from one player to another to join in to particular alliances and so on, they happen. And this is going to be, I mean, I'm glad, actually, in a way, that I'm not too young nowadays, because I think that for young people, it will be a kind of unsettling kind of world, although they won't know the difference, so maybe it's not so bad after all. But as an older person, I'm interested to see, as a kind of an observer, as much as a participant, to see how this world is going to unfold over the next couple of decades.
Straighten me out on this, Dr. Casti. I've had this, if you know the answer to this question, I really hope you do. Please let it out, because otherwise I'll go around self-deluded for until somebody straightens me out on it. I have this theory of compulsory collapse. In fact, I call it Wells's theory of compulsory collapse. Sort of like, you have this wonderful engine and you just keep your foot on the gas all the way to the floor, and it just revs and revs, and it makes all this wonderful horsepower, and it's just great, and it sounds great, and the performance is great, and then the engine blows. It seems like all of these human systems seem to, almost like taking your hands and bringing them up to a peak, making a little imaginary mountain with a really sharp point on it. It seems as though how we're in the beginning phases, and now the system, whether it's telecommunications or finance or anything else, it's not enough that we have our individual economies. Imagine how much more we could do if we had a global economy. So they keep trying to refine this, and eventually they reach this point, and then it all falls down. Has someone named this, or because it appears that these various systems, these socialistic systems have been tried, and the capitalistic systems have been tried, and dictatorial systems have been tried, all these different social systems have been tried, but they all have their limitations, and at one point or another, they collapse, and then some similar mutation comes into being, and then it gets refined and better, and then it descends into chaos, of at least, you know, not necessarily catastrophic chaos, but it'll do till the catastrophe gets here. Mm-hmm. Do you find this to be the case in studying these systems that constitute potential X events?
Well, I talk quite a lot about this very issue, this process you've just now described, in my book, X Events. And I was actually motivated to dig into this a little deeper when I read a book by an American archaeologist named Joseph Tainter. Tainter wrote a book in 1988 called The Collapse of Complex Societies. And he makes the argument, which I find a pretty convincing one, that whenever a society, or you could scale it down to a group or a company or whatever, whenever a society faces a problem, the standard response is to create a new level of, I'll call it bureaucracy, which is designed to address that problem. Okay. Now, a good example, for instance, was the 9/11. After that terrorist attack at the World Trade Center, or the bombing in the World Trade Center, the U.S. government had a problem. And the problem was terrorism on U.S. soil. And so the answer to the problem was to create a new level of bureaucracy, which we now know even has a name, the Department of Homeland Security. And almost for sure, that level of bureaucracy will still be there long after the last terrorist has departed to terrorist heaven. And so what happens the next time you have a problem? Well, another layer comes in. And at some point, all of the resources of the society are consumed just maintaining the current structure, maintaining. So what happens then when the next problem comes online? Well, there's no resource left to address that problem, so it gets ignored, essentially. And then the next problem. And pretty soon, you have a situation where there's so many problems and not enough resources to address them that the whole society is tipped over the edge, and you have a collapse. And it's usually not a slow, gradual fade into the sunset type of thing, but it's pretty rapid, like the former Soviet Union, for instance. And so I call this term complexity overload, this process, complexity overload. And Tater, in his study, and he studied many civilizations from the past, he makes the argument, he says that he only knows of one society in history that ever sort of voluntarily downsized in order to avoid that collapse, and that was the Byzantine Empire. I don't know if he's right or not, but whether it's one or none, it's very few. The typical pattern is collapse, and then something new starts up, and the process starts all over again. Now, in my book, X Events, I extend this argument a little bit by basically saying, suppose you have not just a single system, like a single society, but think about the issues that you just raised, the infrastructures of modern society, you know, power, water, food, etc., transportation, communication. These are various systems that by themselves have certain levels of complexity, which is usually I think of as degrees of freedom of action. How many degrees of freedom do you have to act? And generally speaking, the more you have, the more complex you are. Well, these systems are in interaction with each other. And so what this creates then is what I think of as a complexity gap. One of the systems, to just take two systems, one of them will have a complexity greater than the other one. Now, in general, those complexities are changing over the course of time, and as long as that gap doesn't get too big, the two systems can sort of harmoniously interact. But at some point, maybe one of the systems becomes much more complex than the other, and the gap widens and widens. And at some point, it's like stretching a rubber band. At some point, you can sort of feel that this thing is getting ready to snap. You can feel it even in the tension in your fingers as you're stretching this rubber band. You don't know exactly where it will be, but you know you're entering the danger zone. And if you keep stretching it, it will snap. It won't just gradually go back to its old form. It will break. And then you have to get out a new rubber band and start the process all over again. So I think that this is a very, very common process in all social organizations. And my argument in my book, X Events, is that this complexity gap, this growing of a complexity gap, is a way of characterizing and even measuring, if you like, risk. Risk in environments where you don't have any data about the events. They haven't happened in the past, or they haven't happened often enough that probability and statistics can be used to measure the risk. So this is my idea for how to measure and characterize risk in environments where you're dealing with, I'll call them the unknown unknowns. So it's very
right. Is that Rumsfeld thing?
That's from Rumsfeld. So I have to thank him for that. Really, I don't thank him for too much, but I certainly thank him for that categorization.
Yeah, a good quip every once in a while is redeeming. Now, these societies, when there's a big societal upheaval like that, do we find that they recover fairly quickly as we go into our future? In other words, it was harder to put together the round table back in the old days. We had the William Wallace thing with the "you gotta unite the clans." Is the recovery time shortening any, or is it a drug out rough process.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by recovery. Certainly, by recovery, I would not interpret that to mean a return to how things were before you had the crash.
No, just functioning. It seems like it took the Soviet Union about 10 years after Gorbachev left to sort of get their sea legs back and kind of cut down on the gangster thing.
Yeah, I think that you're right in that respect. My sense is that the time of recovery back to a more or less functioning civil society is shorter, just like everything else in life nowadays. Everything seems to happen faster. Bad things happen faster. Recoveries happen faster. But one thing is for sure, the state that you go back to when you are supposedly recovered is very different than when you were before you crashed. And so there are many people nowadays who talk about, you know, the USA of being in a early stages of one of these collapses. And I certainly would not argue against that. I think that whether it's now or a few years from now, it's almost inevitable that it will happen. Nobody stays on center stage forever. And,
right.
And also, nobody ever seems to leave center stage voluntarily. They usually have to be dragged, kicking and screaming off into the sideline. But the irony of that, in my opinion, is that almost without exception, when you go back and look at nation states that were on center stage, you know, the British Empire, or you could even talk about the Soviet Union, but I don't think it was a center stage place, so China a long time ago, or European countries, France or Spain back in a few centuries ago, almost always once they get essentially kicked off center stage, and when they come into the recovery phase, they're much better off. They're much better off as losers, if you like, than they ever were as winners. And so I don't think that losing your position as, let's say, a preeminent global power is necessarily a bad thing. Just like I said earlier in the show, in the short term, it might be painful, but in a longer term perspective, you can see it as a blessing.
We've got a couple of minutes before we have to take our network break, but when you say, what were they doing poorly when they were at the top of their game, that they were doing better at the, well, not at the top of their game, just kind of being players, regular players, not necessarily champions. Well, are there any symptoms, any of those things stand out as being sort of consistent among collapsing civilizations?
Well, you know, a few years ago there was a big bestseller by the Yale historian Paul Kennedy. It was called The Rise and Fall of Global Powers, or Great Powers, I think. And his argument, which I think is also a very valid one, is that what these countries were all doing is what he called imperial overstretch, overreach. They were basically trying to encompass the globe, you know, and you think about the British or think about the Spanish and so on. They were all out grabbing up territory as far as they could reach. And eventually they reached too far and they fell off the edge. And the USA is no exception in that respect. In fact, even where I live right now, I mean, think about the former Austro-Hungarian Empire, which didn't cross oceans, but it certainly crossed what are today many national boundaries.
Yes. And
it was a case of a similar type. It wasn't that long ago. It was only, you know, 100 years or so ago. So, you know, you still see the remnants of it. If you go around the Ringstrasse of Vienna, the buildings are all still here. It's just the emperor's gone. So, it's too much stretch. In my terms, in the terms from my book, X Events, I would call it complexity overload.
Well, I think I would probably have to be a little more flippant and call it Icarus effect. We'll be back with Dr. John Casti. Okay. Excellent. Dr. John Casti, X Events, the end of everything. We'll discuss a few of those components when we continue, as we carry on through the night on Coast to Coast AM.